Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of April 30th, 2019. The Untouchables, the latest in-depth report by the Post and Courier, looks at the secretive world of judicial discipline in South Carolina. Over the past two decades, 1,000 complaints have been lodged against judges, but none have been published publicly, defying the law of probability, critics say. We talk with reporter Joe Cranny about his eye-opening report. Also, look alive, Rock Hill, it's this week. Our live taping is taking place May 2nd, Thursday, at Rock Hill Brewing Company at 6 p.m. We'll have giveaways, swag, Russ McKinney will be there with trivia. We're going to have Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier and Jeffrey Collins with the Associated Press with me. We're going to be talking about all things politics and session in 2020. So come on out May 2nd at 6 p.m., the Rock Hill Brewing Company. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who wrote the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections during the slow parts of the Avengers Endgame movie. I know you have time. That's a long movie, folks. Or while you recover from your deep depression caused by the Capitals losing to the Carolina Hurricanes. We know, Jamie. It's a tough time. I'm there with you. Leaders, reach out to Jamie. Lift him up. His DMs are open. Open your DMs, Jamie. And now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present. But here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, after a seven-month search, a week of interviews with four finalists, and a day of protests, the University of South Carolina Board of Trustees voted Friday to continue searching for a president to succeed Harris Pastides, this according to the state newspaper. The board had been criticized because the finalists are all men and three of them are white. Tensions reached a boiling point on Friday when roughly 100 student activists protested the board not only for selecting exclusively male finalists, but for finalist Robert Castlin's comments during a presidential forum that binge drinking contributes to sexual assault. Brendan Kelly, the chancellor at USC Upstate, is named the interim president right now. He will take on the new role August 1st, the day after Pastides retires. Number two, education reform is stalled in the Senate and is dead for the year. I sat down with Senate Majority Leader Shane Massey and Minority Leader Nikki Setzler on This Week in South Carolina on Friday, where the two said more time is needed to deal with the most recent education overhaul. However, they say teacher pay raises, which are a part of the proposed budget, and additional infrastructure funding for high-poverty school districts are big steps toward fixing the state's education system. Watch the episode on scetv.org/thisweekinsc. The teachers group SC for Ed is planning a march on the Statehouse this Wednesday, with many teachers planning to take the day off to participate. So something to keep your eye on out there. Number three, NPR reports that the Trump administration is postponing controversial plans to greatly expand oil and gas drilling off of the nation's coast, this following a recent setback in court and months of pushback from coastal communities. Last month, a federal judge in Alaska ruled that President Trump exceeded his authority when he signed an executive order to lift an Obama-era ban on oil and gas drilling in parts of the Arctic and Atlantic Oceans. The decision immediately reinstated those protections and was a major blow to the administration's efforts to boost oil and gas development across the country. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster called the announcement great news. And number four, the AP reports that the South Carolina House has passed legislation that would ban almost all abortions once a fetal heartbeat is detected, which is typically around the sixth week of pregnancy. Lawmakers voted 64-22 on Thursday on a routine vote to send the legislation over to the Senate after spending more than 5 hours debating the bill before a key vote on Wednesday. The bill has little chance of becoming law this year after missing a key legislative deadline, which you know as crossover. And for our new segment, Florida Man News, we give you a new headline each week, just a little taste of the most captivating Florida Man news there is out there. This week, Florida Man threatens to kill landscapers for leaving grass clippings on his walkway, deputies say. And just like this poor Floridian sidewalk buried under grass, we too buried the lead. Get your lawn off my sidewalk. We've seen several in-depth stories this year on serious issues within the criminal justice system, including the extent of civil asset forfeiture in the state, sheriffs who seem to operate above the law, a solicitor who pleaded guilty to a federal wire fraud charge, while a state case for other charges is pending. And now a report looking into South Carolina's judicial branch is raising oversight concerns. South Carolina's circuit court judges have been described as the untouchables. Over the past 2 decades, 1,000 complaints have been lodged against some, but there have been no disciplinary actions taken. It's not even clear what actions have transpired in these cases following a complaint, to the frustration of many. The Post encouraged Joe Cranny, along with ProPublica, looked into the secretive nature of the Commission on Judicial Conduct, which is responsible for monitoring judicial issues, and looks to see if justice is truly blind in South Carolina. Joe, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Gavin.
Joe, it's been like forever since you've been on the show. We were just talking about it's been since the hurricane.
Yeah, it's been about 6 months. I'm very happy to be back, though. I still listen every Tuesday.
I appreciate that, Joe. And like we said, we were going to have you on the Sheriff's episode, too, that big in-depth report that you and Tony Barlamy worked on. But scheduling conflicts arose. But nevertheless, you're here now. And I want to talk to you about this great report that just came out. Tell us what this commission does and maybe some key findings of your report, which I know it's kind of hard because there was, you know, so much you could go off of, essentially.
Yeah. A branch of the South Carolina Supreme Court is called the Commission on Judicial Conduct. It's basically a judicial ethics agency, and pretty much every state in the country has something like this, which is an agency that collects, investigates complaints against state judges. South Carolina's was created in 1997 after there were a series of scandals against some judges in the state. And so for the past roughly 20 years, they've collected, investigated, and processed complaints against everything from a state circuit court judge down to a municipal judge who handles like traffic court disputes. So part of the thing that the work that we did was looking at is, you know, just exactly what this group has found and to what extent do South Carolina judges have ethical oversight.
And what you found was kind of difficult. I mean, were you surprised by the secretive nature of this process and the lack of available information regarding this process?
Yeah, what we found is that when you consider the state-level judges, the major judges in South Carolina that handle major criminal cases and major civil cases, those are our circuit court judges. The Commission on Judicial Conduct has investigated more than 1,000 ethics complaints filed against those judges since 1997. And not one of those cases has led to any disciplinary action, at least not publicly. So because of the secretive nature of the way the Commission on Judicial Conduct works, there's very little public assurance that the complaints against those judges were taken seriously, and there's very little assurance that our judges basically have been kept under watch. We don't know because there are no public records of the work that this group has done over the past 20 years, despite this, you know, significant pile of complaints that have come in.
And that commission's made up of judges and non-judges, too. So is there, since there are a majority of judges on this commission, that they might be looking out for the best interests of their colleagues?
The American Bar Association sets standards for these kinds of groups. Like I said, pretty much every state has something like this. So the ABA, which is the nation's largest legal organization, they set standards for judicial ethics agencies. And they say and have said for decades that the makeup of these commissions should not have a majority of judges. It should have an even split of judges, lawyers, and lay people. They actually call for 4 judges, 4 lawyers, and 4 lay people. That's what they say is like the best model for this system. Mm-hmm. South Carolina, unlike many other states, has a majority of judges and has had as much as 3/4 of its membership of judges over the past 2 decades. Right now, with a 26-member Commission on Judicial Conduct in South Carolina, 14 of those 26 members are judges. It's the 4th highest ratio in the country right now. And even in states where there have been a significant number of judges on the makeup of the commission, we found that even in those states, there have been public actions taken, disciplinary actions taken against judges. So it does raise the question here, with the majority of judges on our commission over the years, with a significant majority, as much as 3/4, like I said, how seriously those complaints have been taken by those people and whether or not this method of self-policing is actually effective with ethical oversight.
And are we the only state with a perfect judiciary in a sense? I mean, I know you're saying that, you know, some municipal and some county judges have been dinged. I think about 80 is what you reported. But I guess a perfect judiciary when it comes to circuit court, it seems like apparently there are no problems or haven't been any problems for the past 20 years. But are other states situated like South Carolina is?
That's an important distinction. So the Commission on Judicial Conduct has disciplined dozens of what we refer to as lower level judges, county and city judges. But we looked at our major trial judges, which are judges known as judges of general jurisdiction, General Sessions Court in South Carolina. Those are our circuit court judges. And the zero number that we have, which is zero disciplinary actions taken against those judges, we found just only three other states in the country. We looked at all 50 states. Just three other states in the country have not disciplined a major trial judge in decades. Those states are Delaware, Hawaii, two very small states who receive very little complaints every year. And the other, interestingly enough, is Virginia. Mm. That is interesting because Virginia is the only other state in the country with a legislature that elects judges. South Carolina has this very distinct process for electing our state circuit court judges, and that is the General Assembly votes on them. Virtually every other state in the country, you have either public elections of judges or the governor appoints them. In South Carolina, we have a legislative panel that nominates candidates, and then we have the General Assembly that votes and selects judges to the bench. The only other state that does that is Virginia. And interestingly enough, that was the only other large state that we found that has not disciplined a trial judge in decades.
Hmm. Very interesting to kind of point that out, because it just seems like, you know, the law of probability would just kind of say that the likelihood of someone having some issue or some, you know, some misconduct problem would, I mean, over two decades would, you know, that's more than likely to happen during that time period. But I want to, you know, speak of the Judicial Merit Selection Committee, which is that committee in South Carolina that helps vet judges that judicial candidates that then go to the General Assembly for election. Do you know if there's any way of these lawmakers and these other people on that committee to know if someone's been getting complaints, if these judges have been getting complaints, or is there, I mean, would they know about that in any way?
That's another something like a loophole in our process, is that the Judicial Merit Screening Commission actually is able to review ethical grievances that have been filed against circuit court judges upon their screening. Mm-hmm. So we have 49 circuit court judges in South Carolina. Every 6 years, they are rescreened by this nominating panel before they go up for reelection in the General Assembly. That panel has a pretty broad authority to investigate and background these judges before they nominate them. Part of that process is they are able to review any disciplinary actions taken against those judges, even if they were private or public. So in theory, yes, the panel can review any sanctions that the Commission on Judicial Conduct may have taken against the circuit court judge. But we know from the public record that none of those sanctions have occurred publicly. So it is possible that the screening panel has reviewed private sanctions against those judges. But when the reports about the candidates are forwarded to the General Assembly and when those reports are made public, the records of the disciplinary actions are shielded. Hmm. So we have another step in the process where the entire disciplinary procedure is occurring behind closed doors, even with this oversight panel, which is formed and created supposedly with the idea of transparency and oversight. They review those disciplinary actions behind closed doors, and it does not become part of the public hearings from the screening committee.
So we just don't know about...
We just don't know. I think that's the bottom line of this story. We have an ethics watchdog that was created in the 1990s in response to some scandals. Mm-hmm. Cronyism, there was a really, really bad case where a family court judge was coercing a woman into sex in exchange for custody of her children, and the state said they were taking action. They were creating this new office that was going to take this more seriously. And well, more than 20 years later, there's very little to say about the work they've done because it's all been done in secret and no public action has taken place.
Do you know why? I mean, is it in the law that created the Judicial Conduct Commission? Is there something that prevents them from putting this information out there, that prevents them from making it public? Is it a way to maybe help prevent a judge not get tainted in future proceedings? You know, should they be, like, you know, continually be complained against, you know, maybe from disgruntled people?
It's a system that puts professional privacy over transparency. Mm-hmm. They think that the judges should be shielded from accusations. And unless the accusations are investigated, processed, and a judge is actually disciplined, those cases should not be made public. Now, I should say, in fairness to South Carolina, many states have similar systems where unless a disciplinary action is taken, the records are kept from the public. But unlike other states, South Carolina has not taken public disciplinary actions. So we have no public files of any complaint ever filed against a circuit court judge ever, even though we know more than 1,000 of them have come in. Because they haven't taken that extra step of disciplining one. They say it's because we have really great judges and that a lot of the complaints that come in aren't legitimate or they don't apply to the judicial ethics standards. They're more of an issue of court disputes. You know, a lot of people who file complaints are just upset about the outcomes of their cases, so they're complaining about a judge's action. The Commission on Judicial Conduct would say that's not our area. We're only interested in a judge's personal conduct or any issues that where a judge's behavior may have run afoul of the ethics codes.
Joe, can you talk about one of those cases? I know you only got access to only a handful of complaints, really. Can you elaborate on maybe one of the cases, one of the bigger cases that you looked at in your reporting and what the outcome of that was?
So one that was really striking, a complaint that we obtained, was made by a Greenville attorney by the name of David Flowers, who in 2008 accused a circuit court judge of colluding with a lawyer friend to give the guy these exorbitant attorney's fees as part of a pretty high-profile civil case. It was the Charleston Diocese clergy abuse case. And the lawyer for the victims was a gentleman from Mount Pleasant by the name of Larry Richter. He has a close, long personal relationship with Circuit Court Judge Diane Goodstein. Goodstein was the judge in that case, and she awarded Richter $2.5 million in attorney's fees as part of this $12 million settlement. So roughly 20% of the settlement goes to the lawyer for his fees, which isn't necessarily unusual for large civil settlements. But when Richter submitted his billing records for the time that his staff worked and his lawyers worked, the billing records included a lot of curious entries, including one lawyer who said he worked 96 hours in one day. There were several entries by staff members on the date of February 30th mm-hmm. in 2004 and 2005, which is a date that does not exist.
Ever.
So David Flowers, who has represented abuse victims as a lawyer in South Carolina for a couple of decades, he was the lawyer who handled the Porter Gaud private school abuse case, which is a really high-profile case from the late 90s. He ended up representing one of the victims in the class settlement and learned of all of these unusual billing records, and Flowers knew of this relationship that Richter had with Judge Goodstein. And in his grievance, he said there appears to be something really wrong here, that this lawyer got these fees in this case and that the judge approved them despite these records of work that Flowers alleged were just not legitimate.
Mm-hmm. Nothing ever came out of it.
June 2008, David Flowers filed the complaint with the Commission on Judicial Conduct. He wrote to them that he has records to support these allegations. He has documents, including the billing records themselves. He sent that in a letter to the disciplinary office that investigates the complaints. He didn't hear back. 6 months later, he got a letter from them that said the complaint was dismissed.
Hmm. And that's it. I mean,
that's it.
You don't get any real closure at that point. I mean, and this kind of goes back to my question about oversight and reporting. I mean, there is a requirement for them to submit what an annual report, but like you reported, they're pretty thin. I mean, do they even tell you what offenses complaints have been filing about?
They include summary statistics. They're 2 to 3 pages, these annual reports. They include a tally of the number of complaints that come in, and that's broken down by judge. So every year, roughly 70 to 80 complaints are filed against circuit court judges. We have about 49 of them, and about double that amount in complaints come in. So if you tally that up over the years, that's how we got to more than 1,000 complaints since 1997. The summaries also include the types of alleged offenses, which is important because according to the annual reports, the majority of alleged offenses are like the judge was biased or the judge didn't like me or stuff, something like that. Mm-hmm. But there are other alleged offenses based on these summary statistics that include conflicts of interest, improper influence. From time to time, people have even alleged criminal activity by judges. But because we have no public records on the other end, we don't know any details of those accusations. We don't know how seriously the commission took them. Obviously we ultimately do know that no judge has been disciplined for anything like that, at least on the state level with circuit court judges.
Are there any changes expected going forward? Any reaction from your reporting at this point or any plans for more?
I think it's interesting because the American Bar Association did actually study South Carolina's system in 2008, and they recommended several changes. One of the changes they recommended was to add more public members to our commission. So in 2008, when the ABA recommended that, South Carolina actually did add more public members. Today, we still stand with a majority of judges at 14 out of 26 members. But if the state were following the ABA standards, we would bring that down to an even split. of judges, lawyers, and public members. The other couple of things the ABA recommended was basically the state just needs to make the system for processing complaints go a bit smoother and make it a little bit easier for people who file complaints. I mean, a lot of times people filing complaints are lay people like you and me who maybe don't have much experience with the court system. They might not know about what kind of language to use. They might not be that familiar with the judicial canons of ethics that judges have to adhere to, but they have a concern about a judge's behavior and they want to air that grievance. So sometimes they write handwritten letters. Sometimes they type it up in like a 12-page rambling grievance. Others are very organized and include like detailed complaints with attachments as exhibits, similar to like a civil lawsuit. But because there's no standardized process, it can be hard maybe for the disciplinary office to go through those and find what is legitimate and what is not legitimate. So the ABA recommended make an online portal where people can submit complaints online. Give them a standardized form where you ask them specifically what you need to know as a disciplinary office. You know, name of the judge, what county do they work in? Did you have a case in front of them? When was it? What happened? What's your concern? And, you know, did they violate this judicial ethics canon or this one or this one? Something standardized so that when you are processing the complaint, you can check off these boxes and maybe dismiss it or forward it for investigation. As opposed to now where you're wading through these rambling sometimes complaints that can be difficult to process.
But when it comes to reorganizing the makeup of the commission, is that something that would be required for the State General Assembly to have to do themselves, or is that something that they can do internally within that commission?
The commission falls entirely under the power of the Supreme Court. It is technically an office of the Supreme Court. So tomorrow, if the Supreme Court wanted to, they could hand down an administrative order that restructures the Commission on Judicial Conduct. It's kind of interesting because we have 26 members. It's like a really large commission. Most of them are no more than 12 members, and in the country that is. And the ABA basically recommends that. They say keep it relatively small. Don't make it this big bureaucratic body. Don't have a majority of judges. Like that was another thing the ABA said in 2008. Is like it's not really clear why we need to have 26 members in our commission. I think next to another state, South Carolina has the second most members of its commission. So I think if you had an ABA expert study the system again this year, they might recommend that too. It's like, you know, just set it up through the ABA model of four judges, four lawyers, four public citizens to create a 12-member commission. Because when you do that, you reinforce the public confidence that this stuff is taken seriously.
So a lot going on, like we said at the top, just with criminal justice and the judicial system in South Carolina right now. And like you're telling me, we'll be seeing more coming from you guys and the Post and Courier going forward this year. So be sure to check out the Untouchables at thepostandcourier.com, and we'll have a link on our show notes. And Joe, thanks again for all your good work and for being on the show this week.
Thank you, Gavin.
It's that time again for some campaign trail news updates. We're looking at the latest in 2020-related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation.
Brown liquor.
Starting off, Governor Henry McMaster is the sixth most popular governor in America with a 57% approval rating. This according to a Morning Consult poll. Massachusetts Republican Charlie Baker led the pack with a 73% rating. Speaking of polling data, the most recent Winthrop poll found that Republican respondents continue to support Senator Lindsey Graham, giving him a 74% approval rating. More findings include that 59% said that the United States should not pay reparations to African Americans, 60% said local governments should be allowed to ban single-use plastics, and 41% of respondents said that raising teacher pay is one of the best ways to fix education in South Carolina. Attorney General Bill Barr will appear before both the U.S. Senate and House Judiciary Committees this coming Wednesday, May 1st and Thursday, May 2nd, respectively, to testify about the handling of Robert Mueller's investigation. The House Judiciary Committee will also have Mueller testify before it on May 23rd, so mark your calendars for that. But Senator Lindsey Graham, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, remains not interested in having Mueller before his committee. And a little SC 2020 watch. Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg will be campaigning in South Carolina this weekend. This is both of their first trips to South Carolina since declaring their candidacies. We'll have a trail bite for you next Thursday following their visit, so stay tuned. And we'll have some more details on their visits on our Twitter this week, so check that out, at @SCLeadPod. And since we recently upgraded from a Biden watch to a Biden warning, we're now in a Category 1 Biden storm, y'all. So, batten down the hatches because they're coming. And Biden has already hired Kendall Corley, a veteran Democratic strategist and expert on Black and Southern voter outreach, as his state director in South Carolina. This according to McClatchy, D.C. Corley was most recently the political director for the 2018 gubernatorial campaign for Democrat James Smith. And this Thursday, we'll have a trail bite for you from one of New Jersey Senator Cory Booker's stops in the state during his three-day tour over the weekend. So check that out. It doesn't cost you anything extra to get our trail bites. You subscribe, they come on your phone. It's free. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is here with some state trivia for us? Well, he's back. Russ.
Back.
What do you got?
Well, let's keep talking about judges. Mm-hmm. Article 5 of the state constitution provides, you know, for a uniform system of justice throughout the state. For centuries, the judicial system in the state was just a real mishmash of courts and court systems. In the early 1970s, there were at least 6 different types of trial courts. As you know now, we only have one in the circuit court is the major trial court in the state now. Mm-hmm. And all of those courts back in the day had all of these confusing appeal routes. It was just a mess. So between 1975 and 1990, over a 15-year period, using a model recommended by the ABA, the state constitution was revised by the General Assembly and the voters to create some consistency in South Carolina's court system. So today we have the appellate courts, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and then we have the trial courts. At the center of that, of course, is the state circuit courts. And all of the judges, directly or indirectly, are decided by, you guessed it, the South Carolina General Assembly.
Yes.
They pick the judges one way or another through out-and-out elections to recommendations via the governor, et cetera, et cetera. But there's one judicial office in this state that is an elective office, popularly elected by the voters. Now, we're not just talking about a single judge, but a category of judges that campaign for office and elected. So which judge are we referring to? A, county court judges. B, family court judges. C, probate court judges. D, master in equity court judges.
You said this one is elected.
Popularly elected.
By the voters.
By the voters. All the others in the unified court system, you know, are determined by the members of the legislature. Believe it or not.
Makes us one of the unique states in the country. So we said
county court judges, family court judges, probate court judges, master in equity court judges.
No, I think it's going to... I'm going to go with master in equity. I'm between that and probate, but I think master in equity.
Master in equity. Yeah. Well, the answer is probate court.
Oh, brother, this guy stinks!
Probate court judges, they resolve all claims and disputes involving wills and estates and trust, and they rule on involuntary commitments of citizens to various forms of supervision sometimes. Not a real pleasant duty that probate court judges have. There are 46. There's one elected in each county.
What do my master in equity guys do?
Master in equity guys are they basically assist circuit court judges in kind of handling lower cases where there are lower money disputes, that kind of thing. A circuit court judge may hand something down to a master in equity court judge to handle that. And, of course, those master in equity court judges are appointed by the governor upon recommendation of members of the Senate.
Mm, very exciting positions within our judicial system. And everyone's getting pay raises. Thanks, Russ.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org, listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio, and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and southcarolinapublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, Spotify, or wherever you find podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at SCLEDEPOD, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at SCLEDPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on April 29th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. Sleepy Hollow is just the origin story of Johnny Depp. Ichabod Crane? More like Johnny Depp.